The Winners Club is the weekly podcast that shares the highlights and insights from some of the most meaningful and impactful conversations from the number one community on Clubhouse, The Winners Club.
So, Rob, really glad to see you've joined us. I don't know if you're in Annapolis or New York, but welcome to the stage and really like to kick off your thoughts.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you, James. Great to join you again. I am in Annapolis outside of Washington, D.C., and it's a stunning day here, too. Very happy to join you. You know, we started this series around managing brand reputation in the roaring 20s because of our belief that there were huge opportunities, but also very significant risks. And if this Winners Club session does you any good, it's to help you be out ahead of this more than most, because you can help your client organizations or just whatever organizations you work with to see both the upside opportunity, but also to be very aware of the risks. I really think on a good day in our field, the communications field, we help our clients to see around corners. We're sensors of social change out ahead of most, social scientists, seeing things that are coming. So that's the intention of this series. And it did start with the overall premise that we're entering the roaring 20s. And for those of you who joined over the last couple of weeks, you know that I meant that not in just the way of the roaring economy, but also the roaring of the disenfranchised, the have-nots. And so I want to start just by reprising the premise of that. Just since we started this series a couple of weeks ago, I'm seeing more and more signs of the positive side of roaring, but it's starting to get crazy. I said we would start using the word bacchanal for the first time in a long time, which means an occasion marked by wild and drunken revelry. I'm starting to see it, and I'm telling you, mark my words, over the next couple of months, as things really open up, you're going to see more of it. But just in the last week, I've seen a number of stories about, have you heard this term, revenge travel? It makes sense. People have been saving a lot of money, and now they're getting sweet revenge by going on trips that are much more expensive than they ever went on before. So luxury travel is very much in. I saw a story that said dive bars are out, fine dining is in. You know, home sales are through the roof, and you better show up with cash. But an interesting indication of the roaring 20s, goods, and therefore the ascendancy of Bernard Arnault as the richest man in the world. Did you all see that? You know, we're used to, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, one of those guys. But now Bernard Arnault, the CEO of LVMH, Louis Vuitton, Moet Hennessy, and the owner of the House of Dior, is the richest man in the world. $188 billion past Jeff Bezos. They've actually been trading the title off every day in the last week. I didn't even see Mr. Arnault coming from, out of the pack into being the richest person on the planet. But what a sign. They say it's because of the sale of unexpected jump in sales of luxury goods in China and the United States in particular. So people are saying, there was a Veuve Clicquot shortage around New Year's this year. They ran out. People are saying, okay, I've been cooped up for so long, I'm going to spend some of this money. It's a very interesting time to be in the travel industry, as we started to discuss last week. But now let me show the other side of that coin. Not everyone is doing revenge travel and blowing money on luxury goods and champagne. There is a huge cut of people that, of course, have more debt than they've ever had, that that foreclosure bans are being lifted in the next month around Europe, the UK, the United States. And so you're going to have I've actually read articles that the tightness in home inventory is going to loosen up in a month because so many foreclosed homes are coming on the market. Now, that's sad. And a lot of people who were disadvantaged before the pandemic were more disadvantaged during the pandemic. People who work hourly, work 7 days a week, two or three jobs, haven't been able to take time off to get vaccinated. So if we saw roaring in the form of, say, Black Lives Matter during the pandemic, when people weren't even supposed to be gathering in crowds, imagine what it's going to be like when people are more than happy to gather and realize that that strategy works and that they can make a point with it. I'm telling you, we're going to be balancing a lot of roaring, crazy, positive, booming economy, travel, it's going through the roof. But then you've got to keep your eye on the downside of those that are less fortunate because their situation is worse. So let me jump back into brand marketing, because I think brands find themselves in the middle of this crucible, this clash in our society. Let's talk about data. I think data is absolutely essential. Advocated for it strongly through the lens of calling it comtech in the communications and public relations industry. Where is the heavy adoption of technology to really be able to use data? So I'm a strong advocate and believer in it, but we have to be careful. On the opportunity side, you've heard me say the most valuable media in the world is the only kind you can't buy. What do we mean by that? Well, there's valuable media out there that you can buy, digital banner ads, all kinds, you know, Instagram sponsorships, television advertising, et cetera. But the earned side of media is recognized as increasingly the real currency of our times. That can be the editorial side of the media, a story, a legitimate news story, not an ad, but also can mean a recommendation from a friend, content shared between friends. Sometimes we call it the human channel. That's the real currency of our times. The problem with the earned side, for those of you who have worked in that world, is that you couldn't really track and trace as clearly to sales, or in some cases not at all, to sales, or to other actions, voting for a piece of legislation, voting for a candidate, taking a position. You could much more easily track that through digital ad buys, you know, use of social platforms and search engines, because you had click-through rates, engagement scores, reach scores, right? So that gave that side of the marketing realm a huge advantage. Now, however, that is changing rapidly. Big word, you know, two big words in marketing for the last 10 or 15 years are programmatic and attribution. Programmatic involves the targeting, the use of software to target the perfect targets for your message, likely buyers, psychographics, demographics of your product. And then what is attribution? Attribution, something the ad people know a lot about, but the earned side knows less about. Attribution is being able to attribute why someone decided to take an action. The identification of the series of touch points throughout the customer journey that lead to purchase or action. And what I'm telling you is now our field is able to do that, working with publishers in partnership with them on data that they have. Major publishers, think the giant media companies, we're able to much more clearly go through a process of programmatic targeting and then watch their behavior as they move through that cycle and go all the way through to purchase. We hadn't been able to do that. So gigantic opportunity there, and I'll speak more about that in a moment. But I want to balance it with risks. I'm sure you are getting, as I am, more than ever, the kind of request about, will you allow notifications? I almost always click no because I get too many of them. Will you allow us to track your location? Well, a lot of times I say only while in the app, but other ones like weather.com, I'm going to let them track me wherever I am so I can instantly beam it up and see what the weather is where I am. And now you're increasingly being asked, do you want to share data with other apps? They ask it in one form or another. We quickly click no frequently to that. But interestingly, something I'm learning is a lot of times that's to make you feel better. If you had the opportunity to say no, you're thinking, okay, they're not sharing anything about me. And I would say au contraire, a brand is sharing your data a lot more than you think. And just because you click don't share it with other apps doesn't mean it's not going into other platforms and used in other ways. I think there are huge opportunities, but also risks. And I guess what I would say is just as social platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Google, have come under fire for their use of data, privacy issues, et cetera, and the healthcare space, data privacy around your healthcare has been a big issue. Hacking of big companies and retailers has been an issue. I think over the next decade, the brand use of data, really over the next 2 or 3 years, is going to become a very big issue that's going to have to be managed. And there are ways to avoid the big negatives, which we can talk about soon. But that's my opening premise, David, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes total sense. And I want to come back to opportunities. I do want to maybe go a little bit deeper into the possibilities of the journey you just described when it comes to earned content. I think we're all used to clicking on an ad and assuming that's sending all sorts of signals back to somebody's headquarters about what we're like and what we're interested in. But we may not think about that in terms of articles, news articles that we're reading on the Guardian site or the Economist or New Yorker. So I do want to come back to that. But just before we do that, I just want to welcome my other friend, well, one of friends on the stage right now, somebody I work with daily and actually just wrote a book with, John O'Brien. John, I don't know if you mentioned you might be on the road. So if it's not safe to answer, please do not. But if you're there, we'd love to hear from you. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to comment on before we get into Rob's kind of further dive into that conversation.
No, thanks, David. Rob, great to be here. Sorry, apologies. I think I may have been a victim of revenge holidaying or whatever it was, in that the normal trip to my mother's, which takes about 40 minutes, has taken about an hour and a half because there's a huge flux of traffic to and through Wales across the border with England because the sun is shining and that's a great holiday destination. But no, happy to be back here and look forward to listening to more. So thanks, Rob. Thanks, David. Thanks, everybody else on the stage. Thank you.
Great. So, Rob, if you don't mind, maybe just outline some of the opportunities. I always like to start with the upside first, and then maybe go a little bit deeper into where we're headed with being able to trace a customer journey from earned content.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the ability to track stories. We now have the ability to much more precisely target the people that we want to see stories, and also track their behavior after they've read the story. And it's not just stories, though. It's also influencers, which, by the way, is going to be our topic next week. But in the past, when we work heavily with influencers, think about Instagram influencers, YouTube influencers, Pinterest influencers, etc. We curate them for our clients and work with them. And as we'll talk next week, we make very sure we're clear that sometimes they are paid influencers, and we disclose that. Sometimes they are completely unpaid, and then there's some hybrids in the middle. But we, by and large, we're selecting influencers, and those of you who work in that space, I'm sure, do the same thing, by looking at their number of followers, their reach, their level of engagement, how many of their followers share their content, and, you know, retweet or et cetera. And that was how it was kind of like the reach and frequency model of advertising. You did it based on volume, but also quality, engagement. But imagine if, let's say, you were selling high-end coffee brand. There are many influencers in the coffee space. And rather than just looking at reach and engagement scores, you were able to identify among, let's say, 10 potential influencers, which were the three whose follower base actually purchased high-end coffee. You know, it's not just the number of influencers and they mention coffee and they share content, but knowing that their follower base of 100,000 people, that they have a predisposition to buy high-end coffee. The research all shows that if you want to get people to buy 50% more high-end coffee, you're better to target ones that are already buying high-end coffee, right? So we can now, again, using data sets and partnerships with publishers, we can identify which one of those influencers through their follower base has more of a likelihood to buy that coffee. That is a richer, no pun intended, set for us to follow. And then we're able to take a look at their follower base and begin to identify through anonymized data. We don't know the individuals, but through anonymized data, sales lift. If we were to engage with that influencer for 2 weeks, we can identify through their follower base sales lift through, you know, it's let's say it's follower number 123 and follower number 5456. We don't know their name. We don't know their address, but we can identify sales lift among that influencer's followers. We can do that with a story on the editorial side of news or a series of stories, and we can do it through shared content online. These are possibilities we absolutely didn't have in the past, and they're incredibly strong opportunities. We just have to be very ethical in the way we use them. So that's what I'd comment about additional opportunities.
I totally agree. And you and I have had conversations with clients about this for all the predictable, understandable reasons. They're pretty excited about it. But I guess what are the guardrails that you think our agencies or any agency or any communicator needs to put in place to make sure that the use of that data, application of that data is ethical? You know, is there kind of a shorthand rule of thumb that you use, or is it still too early for us to give that kind of advice?
No, I'll provide some of the advice before we open it up for comments and questions. I do want to say we can do this. We can do this well. One of the things I love about the use of data is it kind of blows up the traditional marketing funnel. You know, we all studied it. Big top of the funnel is awareness, then interest, then consideration, then intent, then evaluation, then purchase. It's a long process. Some people say you need 5 to 7 touch points before you're really going to have an impact on someone making a purchase. This kind of short circuits that from awareness to purchase very quickly, which can be very powerful for marketers. And I'd also say, our research shows that people like personalization. For the most part, they're not against it. They like it. Someone was telling me the other day about their 80-year-old father who was reading articles about garden tools and absolutely loved that he got an ad for the very tool he was reading about 10 minutes later. Now, some people find that a little creepy. A lot of people like it. And so if it's done well, as you said, David, right? Your own example, the Negroni comes to you, the running gear, etc. But the incontinence, garments don't exactly, make you happy about personalization. So we have to calibrate it well. We've all heard the story about the young woman who hadn't even told her mother that she was pregnant. She was 3 to 4 weeks pregnant, and she was getting diaper ads sent to her, and she felt it was an invasion of privacy. So we have to be kind of careful at how we calibrate it. And we also have to avoid the risk as marketers and brands to not be paralyzed by data. Now that we have all this data, my folks are telling me that some clients want so much validation of what they're doing that they get a little bit paralyzed. We still need to strike a fine balance between art and science, actually using some of our intuition in addition to data, because there's first-party data, third-party data, synchronized data, and you can get kind of bogged down in it. So we have to make sure we bring our brains to it too. I guess to your question about how do brands remain ethical and avoid being creepy. First off, greater disclosure, greater opportunities to opt in and to opt out. How many times have you run into a thing that says, by clicking this, you know you've read our privacy policy? I'd say about 10% of the time, it actually makes you scroll through the privacy policy, right? About 90% of the time, you just say, yeah, I read it, because you don't want to take the time. There's a lot hidden in those privacy policies that we kind of have to be a little more visible about. I remember years ago, the U.S. government did something called like the Simple Language Act, because there was too much fine print, right? We probably need less fine print and more obvious print to allow opt-in and opt-out when it comes to data. I also think we need to have highly diverse teams because, you know, you've heard about algorithmic bias. There, if anything is run by AI or machine learning, it's initially coded by human beings, and human beings have a built-in bias. So we need racial and ethnic diversity on teams. We need economic diversity. And one thing that I'm kind of happy to see, I mentioned that I do these corporate narratives for companies, and it's not just the narrative of their company every time. I've been doing a lot of narratives around the ethical use of artificial intelligence. What's our point of view? And I think there might increasingly be a role for data ethicist at companies. It could be called, by the way, the chief communications officer. It could also be the, you know, involvement of the head of diversity to kind of look at how, if the data is handled only by a certain set of data scientists in marketing, I'm not sure it's getting enough vetting from other people that look from a multi-stakeholder view of how you're using that data. How would this look if it ran on the front page of the, you know, the New York Times? And so I think the first role, the first need is to look at the team that is actually deciding how your data is being used and open up that team so that more people can weigh in on that. I think that's incredibly important. You have to think about it. You know, it's a little bit like the golden rule. How would you like to be treated? Where would you like your data to go? And I also think of the notion, just because you can doesn't mean you should. We have substantial new powers, but we shouldn't be weaponizing personal data just to our advantage without thinking about the longer term impact on the individuals whose data is being used, but also on the reputation of your brand as someone who might be taking advantage of the ability to access data today.
Hey, I love the idea of a chief ethics officer, and I love that idea of being either assigned to a chief communications officer or to someone specifically looking over data. And I couldn't agree more with the need to have a team that's representative of the community, not just the functions within an organization, but represents the communities that that organization serves, to help you help us make some human decisions about what we're doing. You know, I was in a conversation with a CEO last week, and we were talking about this some products that you're aware of, Rob, around tracking consumer journeys with earned content. And you know, he asked me, how do you keep it ethical? And I said, well, you know, it needs to meet a pretty strict set of criteria in terms of being relevant to them, being timely in its presentation, making sure that consent is clear. So there are some guidelines we can follow. And he actually interrupted me and said, and it's got to be human. You know, to your example of the woman getting ads for baby products before she's told anybody in her family she's pregnant. Yeah. You've always got to give the benefit of the doubt to the human and think about how's that really going to strike them. Even if that's really convenient for them in the moment, it might strike them as a little bit inhuman. So I just like this notion of assigning some board level accountability to ethics, but also a general value across the organization that will stay human. I don't know if you wanted to, you know, you and I discussed before this show some of the risks. I don't know if you wanted to outline some of those now, or if we should reset the room and come back to Q&A from the audience, which is
yeah, let's reset the room. There's plenty of risks. We can talk about it when we come back.
Great. James, do you want to reset? And can you, I know we have a slightly different process for taking questions from the audience. I'm not ignoring the hands that I see raised, but there are going to be too many for me to manage the normal way or the usual way. Do you mind resetting for us and talking us through that process?
Yeah, of course. Absolute pleasure. And what a great conversation we're having so far. I hope everybody is enjoying this. So let me just quickly reset the room. Hello, everybody. Welcome to this very special room on managing a brand reputation. The use of data. Is it ethical or is it just a little bit creepy? I think we're all making our own assumptions here, but I know which side of the fence that I'm already leaning on. Very interesting conversation. This is brought to you by the Winners Club. If you're not yet following the Winners Club, because I can see we've got loads and loads of party hats, which means that you guys have been on the app for less than a week. We can feed them back in to Rob. So I will consider the room suitably reset. David, I'll hand back the reins to you, my friend.
Thank you, James, and thank you for outlining that process. You've done that for me three times, and I keep forgetting how we're doing it on this, but it does make sense. I'm just not capable of having a conversation and monitoring the Q&A, especially when they start coming in by the dozen. So thank you for that. I think John has a question. John, I'm going to come to you just a second. But before I forget, and I think I forgot this last time, I just want to say something about the Winners Club. What a great collection of conversations. And I was great, fortunate to be introduced to you, James, Paul, and Ashley a month or so ago. And it really opened my eyes to the possibilities of Clubhouse, but more generally, just open, frank, honest, timely conversations that are relevant to people in different aspects of business, in this case, marketing, PR, branding, communications. And I just want to give a quick shout out to you guys because you do it better than anybody else I've seen on Clubhouse. So thank you for that, and thank you for making this room possible. John, assume you're in a safe place now, not driving.
No.
That's something you want to ask Rob on this front.
Well, yeah. No, thanks, David. Well, it's actually a bit of an observation with a bit of, an open ask for a response. But, Rob, I absolutely agree in terms of when you talked about, you know, the sort of ethical optics around the use of data and the use in supporting brands and decisions obviously made in that way. I guess I have a personal view, which is that when it comes to ethics, it shouldn't be the sort of occupation of the few. It should be the preoccupation of the many. And I like the fact that Chief Ethics Officer has exactly the same initials as Chief Executive Officer. And although, you know, one would hope that ethics would run through the DNA of a decent and good responsible business, and thereby you could have collective ways of doing it, you know, I would just sort of pose the comment really that, you know, the chief ethics officer of any business should be the CEO. So the CEO can never turn around and say at any time, well, of course, ethics, that's what that person did over there. So that's a sort of observation and a question, if that's worthy of any response. And I've done talking.
No, it absolutely is. I've often thought that the CEO is also the chief reputation officer, the person most responsible for the behavior of the company that leads to their reputation. And yes, I think ethics needs to be pervasive, and it has to be a cultural priority. People have to know that the self-policing mechanisms within an organization will push them out if they go over the line on ethics. Because, of course, the data ethics is done in private, small rooms using coding, and you better have everyone on board for how you're going to use that data, because often the executives running the company don't sufficiently understand it. They're not the ones in there coding. And so you got to have it as a pervasive cultural priority in order for it to work. Great point.
Yeah, thanks for raising that. And I will validate Rob's view of this. When he was my CEO, I can think of a half dozen situations, Rob, where there were salient arguments on different types of work we were considering or requests that were made, and it was always your decision, and you took responsibility for those decisions. And I always admired that and try to replicate that in my own process. But I still like the idea of somebody taking responsibility for the ethics of decisions that we make, because I think it's all too easy just to follow the numbers or let the computer tell you what to do, and you end up in a place that is a negative surprise downstream. So, but I think I reset the room before you had a chance to tell us about some of the risk, and I wonder if you could just outline, and you've touched on that, but if there's anything you didn't get to say on risk before we open up. And I would like to hear from members of the panel. They've been quietly assembling on the stage, and I'm sure there's some good questions there that I'm happy to take directly. Otherwise, please follow the process that James outlined. That's to click on James in the salmon. I think it's a very attractive salmon jumper, Paul, with the novel turquoise background or the handsome Ashley profile. If you go to the link in their profile, you'll be able to get in the audience queue. But I'd love to hear from the panel as well. But Rob, any risks that you wanted to attenuate or
As our capabilities grow, the risks grow. So we throw around terms like algorithmic bias, and let me refresh everyone's memory. Algorithm is, you know, the Google algorithm, at least when I last checked, is refreshed twice a day, 600 times a year, and it kind of determines what you're going to see. And the question is, if you're anywhere near marketing or communications, how much do you know about that particular algorithm and how it changes what you are going to see? And it's very personalized, of course, based on what you've been looking at over time. So just looking at algorithmic bias through an ethical lens, would it bother you to find out that you're not seeing what other people are seeing? Would it bother you to find out that what you see is sometimes based on your postal code, your name, and an interpretation of what you might like based on your name, on your income? Would it bother you if that algorithmic choice that was being made for you meant that you weren't being exposed to healthier for you foods? Instead, you were being exposed to high sugar and sodium foods, or that you were not getting ads for lower rate home mortgages or lower rate car loans? That kind of bias is built into a lot of algorithms, and it is discriminatory. And that's what I mean by data that isn't used as ethically as it could be. You throw into that geolocation data and software, the ability to know where you are at all times and to therefore make offers to you suggestions to you based on where you are. But maybe if you're low income and not in such a great neighborhood, maybe you get a kind of almost stereotypical set of offers and not exposed to things other people get. Books to read. And as we get more advanced in the machine learning and AI, eye tracking online, facial recognition software, which is very much coming into the marketing world, the question is there bias or unethical use of things like eye tracking, of what you're looking at online and therefore feeding you stuff? Or we know in facial recognition, there have been instances of indications of racial bias because they see the color of someone. Moves into the world of brands, we have to be very careful. I hope that sufficiently outlines some of the risks.
Yeah, it does for me. James or Paul, I can't see your queue, so I don't know if there's any questions in the queue.
Yes, there are. We've got loads. This has been a lively behind-the-scenes debate, as I suspected it might be. So we'll go in order in which they came in, if that's all right.
So
Chandra asks, what are your thoughts on buying lists and how accurate the GDPR GDPR compliant they are?
Yeah, actually, I'm no expert on that. So it's a great question, but I don't have a highly qualified answer on it. We obviously buy a lot of lists, and I would have a lot of skepticism about how GDPR compliant they are based on what I know about what's available and whether everyone had the opportunity to opt in or opt out. So I think we almost need to do our own assessment. We probably need more of a clearinghouse to evaluate how GDPR compliant they are. And I think it's a very good question. Sorry, I don't have a better answer.
No worries at all. Is anyone else on the stage? Is anyone else an expert in the GDPR field?
Hey, James, I'm not an expert at all, and I'm definitely not a data privacy lawyer. I do know that what our agencies, and I would say any respectable agency, consultancy, the data that they buy, the lists that they buy, are going to be GDPR compliant, just because we're all forced to show our own receipts and numbers. So I think generally commercially, you're going to be able to trust what's available. I think what's underneath a lot of these are I don't want to call them black market, maybe gray market sources of data, and less scrupulous organizations or causes or companies, we'll always find access to data that's not GDPR compliant. So I think it's incumbent upon us as stewards of either the companies we serve or the brands that we advise to make sure that the data we're using is completely up to code, unquestionably scrupulous in the way it's been gathered. But there's plenty of bad actors out there.
Which actually nicely leads on to the second question, which Sunny asks, what's your view on the rise of data being leaked and the use of scrapped data?
Yeah, I think... once again, I don't know how we're going to address this, but some increased regulation has to be put in place so that we reduce the amount of leaked data. There has to be more oversight of how companies use data, because, as I said, I certainly see enough to know that sometimes when you click, I don't want my data shared, that's giving you a sense of comfort that your data isn't being shared, when in fact it's being shared in multiple ways, just not in the one way that you said you don't want it to be shared.
Yeah, we've got a lot of this kind of questions, actually, and more of them are flying in. So what are your views? So Louise asks, what are your views on buying data? How do you know if the data is legitimate? How would you deal with a company that's selling data of a deceased child? Wow. I know you guys have already mentioned there that the lists that you would buy obviously come from reputable sources, but is there best practices that sort of people who are not, buying data at the level that you guys probably are doing so, is there sort of best practices that people could be aware of that they should be, at least considering when looking at where they're buying their data from?
Oh, yes, yeah, absolutely. It's almost like every other professional service. You have to investigate the source. You have to know that they have a brand that they're worried about damaging, and you have to build up a trusting relationship with them. One of the things that we've had to do at Ketchum is hire a lot of data scientists. I was thrilled to see the number that we're hiring now, and even among our summer interns that were announced today, there are some being hired into analytics and data science, and it's just a growing part of our field. And we're hiring people that come from research companies, that come from digital shops, that come from media buying companies, that are highly experienced in this. So we have had to increase the professionalism of our access to data over the course of the past decade. And I think, you know, getting qualified professionals and reinforcing your ethical priorities is the key way to do that well.
Great stuff. Claire asks, data is playing an increasingly important role in marketing and product development. How can we work harder to involve consumers, i.e. give us a proactive choice? Is there anything that we can be, is there anything we can be doing as consumers that are going to give us a more proactive choice, or is it incumbent on the big brands to sort of, is it going to be the fact that enough of us, as we, you know, we talked about the roaring 20s, you know, enough people sort of roaring in the right direction of what's common, decent and good? Is it just going to come down to that, do we think? Enough people going, do you know what, enough's enough?
You know, I realize now that there was a little bit of method in the madness in putting this trio of subjects following our opening talk. In the trio, you remember, was, is it a positive, meaningful action or clumsy virtue signaling was the first one. This one on data and the next one on influencer. They all kind of intersect. And I think in product development, one of the things that I've learned in the past couple of years is there is not enough diversity in product development. And this notion of do some focus groups and some testing of the product, it really needs to be broadened much more than that. And so the notion of can the consumer have more of an input on it? Imagine if you had a consumer that was multiple consumers and highly diverse, age, economics, race, and involve them a lot more in the co-creation of product. We used to use it as we'll invent the product and we'll use some focus groups to see if they're going to like it. It's still kind of a push model, right? Steve Jobs always said, I tell the consumer what they want next. He had a pretty good track record of it. But for the most part, I think marketing works well when the consumer is more involved and isn't just waiting for you to tell them what they want. And I increasingly like the notion of co-creation at a very much community level, at a real level, instead of in some kind of marketing ivory tower using quant research and qualitative research and focus groups. I prefer literally engaging the consumer in product development. What are the authentic tastes that they like? What are their ancestral tastes in the food category? What are they looking out for in product design that appeals to them, instead of just getting to our own choice and then having them adjust it? I prefer co-creation on the front end.
Awesome stuff. Right, that's all the questions that we had through a minute ago. I'm just going to quickly reset the room again and just explain to everyone once again how to do questions today. We're talking today to Rob, who is at the top left, Rob Flaherty. He is the current chairman of Ketchum, which is one of the biggest marketing, branding, PR, communications agencies on the planet. So Rob has got a very, very much an insider, poacher turned gamekeeper kind of insight that he could share with us today, which is a very rare opportunity to get to speak to someone like a Rob at this sort of. So if you ask a question, it comes through to my screen behind the scenes of this broadcast, and I will re-ask it to Rob. In the meantime,
James, I'm so sorry to cut in. I would never ordinarily do this, but I went to ask a question, and it's funny because of the room title, but I withdrew my question because I felt that I was going to be added to a mailing list, and I already follow the Winners Club, and to get any notifications or anything, it would just really annoy me. So is there any way that you'll allow for a question from
directly? Well, go on then. As you've been so honest, yeah. And this is, by the way, guys, this is not to, I don't even know if it captures your data, frankly. Probably should, because you get loads of questions in. But that would be good marketing practice, wouldn't it? But maybe not ethical. So, yeah, go on, Zamari. While we're here, we'll allow the question live.
I appreciate that, and sorry for being so cheeky again. Rob, it's nice to speak to you. I'm glad that you're speaking about this, and I hope that there's a follow-up conversation to it. Before, you mentioned about being careful about how you calibrate data. Like, you mentioned the example of the pregnant girl that wasn't ready to speak of a pregnancy. How are you or companies actively doing that? How are they actively calibrating data? Thanks. I'm Samara, and I yield for now.
Well, you know, it's an ongoing art and science. You have to always make the decision as you're going through this. You have to have the right people watching very closely to make sure that you aren't kind of, you know, that's why I'm speaking out about this, both inside my company and outside. There needs to be more awareness that it's going on and that it is a choice. And just because you can doesn't mean you should. So there has to be an ongoing dialogue about how far are we pushing this? Here's another kind of battleground for this. Programmatic targeting allows you to kind of sort anonymized groups of people and say, oh, they're gonna love this product, right? But what you find now is it's landing in some pretty strange places, some extreme media channels, some dark web channels, where your brand didn't even realize you were appearing on some extreme right or extreme left kind of settings where there might be calls for violence, that kind of thing. So you have to be having the discussion ongoing. How are we targeting individuals? What media are brands landing in? How do we dial back so that we're not appearing at the wrong time? But it's just a constant ongoing self-education within our field to get people to understand that there need to be guardrails put in place. And I, as the chairman of the company, I probably can't give as detailed of an answer as I'd like, but if our head of analytics were here, Mary Elizabeth Germain, she could tell you more precisely the kind of training we're providing people. But I think you have to provide ongoing training and make sure that everyone's very clear that it's a priority to not go too far. Thank you, Zamari.
James, can I ask a question? Dr. Connor here.
Well, we've lost control now, haven't we, frankly? Zamari's opened the flipping floodgates. Go on, why not? You say, you sound like you're going to ask a sensible question, Dr. Connor. I imagine, with the doctor in the title.
My last question was sensible.
It was sensible, to be fair. And it's really interesting, isn't it, that actually you did want to put your question in because you thought we'd be tracking the data. Really interesting. So that's a useful understanding from our point of view, and also shows us where consumer mindset is around that sort of stuff. Yeah, go on, Dr. Connor. Why not? We're all here now. Forget the question button. Zamari's opened the floodgates. We're going to go rogue and incognito now. Go for it.
Yeah, cool. It's on algorithms. You mentioned algorithms, Rob. And it actually reminded me of the Social Dilemma, that program or that documentary that was on Netflix. And I remember there was a couple of facts there. I think it was about 60-odd% of people that were joining extremist groups because of what they saw on Facebook. And obviously political disinformation, and we saw that with the US electoral campaigns last year and what happened, because essentially people were getting two sides of the, well, different stories really, that was considering what was presented to them on social media. And then there was a big study as well about, I remember, the declines in people's mental health with regard to social media usage and all that. Now, I know those are different areas in that, but in general, what do you think of the social dilemma as such, and the accuracy of what was put out there? Because obviously it's a documentary and it is entertainment at the end of the day. So, like, should we read into the specifics of all the things on it, or is it just more a kind of entertaining thing, entertaining documentary? What do you think of it all?
Well, I tell you, when did it come out? About 6 months ago or 9 months ago? And I watched it and I took it as a pretty much a statement of fact. I didn't find it to be extreme based on what I've observed and all that I've just discussed about, you know, potential bias, et cetera, in algorithms. I think I'm just absolutely fascinated and very disturbed by the polarization in society that has been significantly fueled by people getting access to very different points of view. I mean, within my own immediate, not immediate family, but a larger family, meaning brothers-in-laws, sisters-in-laws, cousins, people that we hang out with at the holidays every year, very close relatives of ours, there is a split opinion about vaccines. And it just fascinates me because these are really smart, great people, high IQ, high EQ, and a third of the family doesn't want to get vaccinated. And I'm like, what are they exposed to that I'm not exposed to? You know, it's too easy to say that it's their opinion. Their opinion was framed by what they are exposed to. And this over-personalization of media choices and, you know, your ability to sort your feed to what you want, or even to look at a major media app and say, hey, you want to personalize this and see sports and business news? And then, of course, you know, cable news, and you have people who literally are only seeing their slice of the world, and it has a profound effect on opinion, even as it relates to what used to be called fact. And I think it's one of the great dilemmas of our time. And I worry about it a lot, that we are not having a common experience anymore. And it's leading to the significant bifurcation of, you know, determining what fact is, right down to our health. And I do think it has a significant effect on mental health. You hear about gaslighting, which is kind of the intentional misleading of individuals, so they think they're, you know, losing their mind or that they're interpreting something incorrectly. There's almost a form of gaslighting going on all the time because of the polarization and fragmentation of media. We used to have a common experience. We used to watch major networks all together, major sports events all together, read a lot of the same things. And now it's so fragmented, and there's such an ability to kind of splinter people off and take advantage of their kind of vulnerabilities that it's truly creepy. And Doctor, that was an excellent question and worthy of a whole segment.
Yeah, I totally agree, John, Rob, and I just wanted to kind of give a related perspective. Before I do that, there's a question, and I didn't catch your name, whether it was Louisa or Louise, and I apologize for that. I'd love to follow up with you. If we can connect on Twitter or Instagram, I'm happy to follow up. You ask a question about how do you basically vet sources of data, and I think there's a better answer than I was able to give you. I just don't know it off the top of my head, but there has to be something. So I'm going to look into this, and I'm happy to exchange with you whatever I can find out. And it was going to bug me if I didn't get to that.
Yeah, well, that's a good point, David. And I started with the inadequate answer, so I'd be happy to make sure that we get a good answer for Louise on that.
I'll find out what I can for all three of us, because I just continued the answer. But you know, to your point, and I couldn't agree more about polarization. I did watch A Social Dilemma. I think it was, you know, at the very least a cautionary tale, and I have no reason to doubt its key points. But there's a book, and it was published, I think, in 2007, a long time ago, and I believe by a Stanford professor. I do have this book. It just happens to be downstairs. I'm going to find it and I will tweet a link to it. I think it's called Persuasive Technology. And the ideas behind the features of Facebook or Instagram or YouTube and probably Clubhouse are ingrained to trigger an addictive behavior. And literally, you get a little dopamine hit every time you see you got a new follower or a new like. That technology and that psychology has been in place for, you know, almost two decades now, getting close to that. So you can imagine how powerful it's become. And I think that's the message I would draw from this, is that we say that the data is the new oil. I wonder if attention is the new oil, or if at least attention is the drilling equipment you use to get to the data. And I think the point is to be very aware of, as marketers and communicators, the data that you're using, where it's coming from, how it's applied. But as a consumer, to be equally vigilant and diligent in what you're drawing conclusions from and how you're making your own purchasing or social or culture or voting types of decisions. So sorry, I wasn't going to find another way to work that in. But Louise, I will definitely find a good source for how we can vet data sources.
Awesome stuff. Right then, so we've had another question via the button. How do we override injustices where algorithms are delivering a result, given the exam debacle of last summer?
Yeah, well, how do we override that? I mean, I think it's a consumer rights issue. I think it's very important that we look at this through the lens of consumer rights, and that there be, I'm not a huge fan of regulation, but there be the right regulatory oversight in order to really make sure that, you know, there's oversight of just about everything else. There probably needs to be oversight of how data is used and how algorithms are developed, so that we avoid that in the future.
Great stuff. We'll open it up to a few more flashes of the mic. I'm going to ask a question, if you don't mind, this week, Rob. What are your thoughts on the use of data, the ethical / creepy use of data, as we start to see more and more technology linked up with the likes of like Aura Ring, for example, where they're really, really pulling down quite a lot of data on your health and well-being? Are you seeing that as a situation which will only get worse, or do you think that's going to be the catalyst, because it is going to be, you know, linked to sort of people's medical records effectively? Is that the catalyst to more regulations coming in, do you think?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I'm a big fan of more data in healthcare. I'm not as concerned as an individual as most people are about someone knowing my health history, I guess because I've been pretty healthy for most of my life, meaning if you had a significant pre-existing condition when you were 20 years old, you'd probably be worried about bias against you, whether it's in hiring or financial matters or just about anything else. I guess I haven't been particularly overly sensitized to that, and therefore I'm a big fan. One of the things that's been crazy to watch, and you've all seen it, is the rise of telemedicine because of the pandemic, the huge rise in, you know, you used to not be able to talk to your doctor on the phone. You used to not be able to, online easily. You used to not be able to quickly transfer health records. And a lot of that was blown up by the pandemic. So you've got this greater willingness on the part of old doctors to, you know, have Zoom telemedicine calls, to give you a prescription, to arrange it through online. And, I view it as a great thing, because I always regarded it as a ridiculous bureaucracy to even get medical records to transfer, taking 3 weeks or something. I think electronic medical records should fly fast, but of course there has to be enough regulation around it so that it isn't then made available to everyone, because we know of many, many, many ways in which you can be discriminated against based on your health history.
Absolutely. Great answer.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Winners Club. If you have taken some practical lessons and learnings from some of the most impactful conversations on Clubhouse, then we would love your support for this show by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts.